You're listening to the Soccer Report Extra podcast with your hosts, Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to the Soccer Report Extra podcast. I'm Bobby McMahon. Joining me is Owen O'Callaghan, and at the controls we have producer Luke Crawford. Champions League continued this week with four games wrapping up the first legs of the round of 16. We'll look back at these matches and look ahead to the Carling Cup final between Arsenal and Birmingham, which is set for Wembley Stadium on Sunday. But first, Champions League. Owen, watching TSN, broadcast of the games this week, and on Tuesday, I was told that the favourites were having some trouble, but looking at the statistics, four away wins, three draws and only one home win from Arsenal, that would tell me the group leaders had a pretty good go of it in the first legs of these games. What's your general take on the outcomes?
Yeah, it's one of the key things about it, apart from, I suppose, the Copenhagen-Chelsea game, is these games are still firmly in the balance as we head into the return games, which is always nice. You don't have teams running away with it after a thrashing in the first game, and then suddenly the second leg is just kind of left as a nothing game. It's interesting. I mean, you know, you looked at teams, even when we were looking ahead to the round of 16 ties, and we were looking at group leaders and the group stages. Is there almost too much importance placed on the group stages? You know, it's like anything when you are involved in a major international tournament and people base your form on, oh, how they did in the group stages. People go into a World Cup, oh, well, they finished top of their group. And it always kind of, you know, gives you a little bit of a snapshot, but whether or not that's a decent snapshot to take from something, you know, when you get into a knockout stage, it's almost like a brand new competition because it's, firstly, you know, you think of group stages, you think of players or teams going away from home, happy to get a draw here or there, scoreless. Oh, yeah, that's fantastic. Pick up a point on the road. It's great. Knockout stages, as we saw in a few of the games, the importance of a scoreless draw as opposed to picking up an away goal and then having your second leg at home. So there's various little nuances involved in knockout stages. So perhaps there's a little bit too much importance placed on the group stages after all.
But these four teams that are going home with wins in their pocket must feel pretty confident just now, because you look at history, I think there's maybe only Ajax in the knockout stages that have ever overturned a home loss in the first leg and gone away from home and got through. So you've got to look some strength there. But let's look at the Leon Real Madrid match. Obviously, a lot of talk about Real Madrid's continuing failures in the last 16. That's six seasons in a row. Mm-hmm. Leon's been a bit of a nemesis for them. What was your take on this game?
I thought it was actually an enjoyable game to watch. It was, you know, it wasn't like the Inter Bayern kind of to and fro frenetic pace, but from a neutral's perspective, sitting there and watching it, you could appreciate, you know, particularly Claude Puel's approach to the game. I think Mourinho, even after the game, was his usual ratty self, complaining that a referee missed a penalty, that his team deserved more, and all the usual kind of stuff that we become accustomed to when Jose is giving his post-game comments. Madrid, obviously, romantically had Karim Benzema, who came off the bench and put them a goal up. But up to that point, something that we had spoken about in the podcast, that they seemed to have trouble creating. There was a clear setup from Lyon to kind of stifle, so Di Maria and Ozil couldn't really get into the game. And up till Benzema's introduction, up top, Madrid really struggled. They had Adebayor up there, Ronaldo obviously playing in support, but they just couldn't really get going. They hit the woodwork twice, but again, it's, you know, you drop that into a review of a game and it sounds quite impressive. But really, outside of those chances when they did hit the crossbar and hit the post, they didn't really have anything else going for them. They brought Benzema in, and then within whatever it was, 30 seconds of coming on the pitch, he ends up scoring the opening goal, which really came from Lyon doing very well. Toulon was on the right side, doing his usual self, dispossessing. Then just the ball ends up kind of getting away from him. It's picked up by Ozil. Quick ball to Ronaldo, quick ball to Benzema, who still had a lot to do from the position that he picked the ball up from, cuts inside onto his right. And I was watching, it was almost in slow motion. Sissoko on the left was coming inside, but because he was guarding Di Maria, it looked as if he was in two minds. Will I commit to throwing myself at Benzema? Or else, if I do that, he's just going to slip the pass to Di Maria and he's pretty much going to have a simple task of putting it in. So Sissoko tracking back just seemed to be caught As to what he should do. Benzema putting it through Lloris's legs and it just rolled into the net. One of those really scrappy goals. But they got it and it gave him an impetus.
You mentioned Di Maria there. It seems to me, watching Di Maria in the last few weeks, he's not nearly as effective as he was at the beginning of the season, playing that left-footed player on the right side. Ronaldo being really two-footed, but Di Maria is very, very one-footed. So much of that sort of outside-in winger idea of the playing the opposite foot on the wing comes down, I think, to the fullback. I think Ribery is one, Robin is one, but they rely on their fullbacks as well to help them. Mm-hmm. Real Madrid on the road, in particular, when Di Maria is cutting inside, Ramos doesn't seem to be getting forward nearly as much as he does at home in the Bernabeu. So is that part of Mourinho's sort of tactics to be negative and just trying to cram the midfield, or is it just something that they're just being overly cautious?
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned the Ramos and Di Maria angle. On the other side, you had Ronaldo, but you had Mourinho going with Arbeloa
instead of Marcelo.
Yeah. And again, you look at, well, offensively, maybe Marcelo gives you something else, but certainly at the back, Arbeloa, you know, arguably people who remember him from his Liverpool days might think otherwise, but he's a more of a solid, dependable defender in that situation. Maybe it was Jose doing his usual kind of away tie, gritty, dogged kind of performance. But I found it, we don't really do it too often, is give managers credit for doing very well. I thought Claude Puel's substitutions.
Three almost at once.
Yeah. I mean, he brought on Pierre, he brought on Jimmy Briand, and it was, you're in that situation where your hand is forced and you kind of need to get that goal to give you a little bit of hope. Okay, what do? We bring on the two fast guys.
Yeah.
And let's try to push Madrid here. And they certainly did. It was the goal, I suppose, can be argued was quite scrappy, but I don't think that they didn't deserve it. I think 1-1 was a fair result. And we mentioned it, that Lyon could cause problems for Madrid. The return leg still to come in Spain, which is a tough task, but certainly I think Lyon are still in this tie and they should still be in this tie. I think they played very well.
Well, I think the interesting way you look at how Lyon set up with Bastos, who's going to miss the next leg.
Yep.
So that's maybe an opportunity for Briand to get in the starting lineup, and Delgado playing wide. I'm not quite sure Delgado will be used in the next leg as well. They'll maybe look a little bit more defensively, but I think if they can get the ball up to Gomis and maybe get some support through Briand on the break, then they could cause some problems.
And the other thing, quickly, because I know we're under pressure time-wise, Lisandro Lopez wasn't playing in that first leg. Now, if they do have him back for the return game. Again, it makes, Puel's strategy and what he does with the formation.
Because it may well be Alessandro, if he is available, plays instead of Gomis.
Yeah, exactly.
As they did a number of times last year in the Champions League.
Chelsea were on their travels. They were in Denmark earlier on this week. Everyone said this was going to be a fairly easy tie for them. And from the first leg anyway, it looks as if they're safely through to the next round, doesn't it?
Well, interesting. I think the Copenhagen or Copenhagen, whichever way you want to say
depending
it.
Depending on what part of Copenhagen or Hagen you are from.
Or if you're Danny Kaye, for some of our older listeners. I thought Copenhagen were one of these great examples that I think you were alluding to earlier on, Owen, where you look at the group performance and I think you see the classic kind of situations usually in the World Cup. Mm. You look at a country that finishes in the top two, you go through the last 16, country's getting a bit excited about it, and then they go out and you realise they just haven't got the extra gear. It took all they had to get into the last 16, and you kind of got that feeling that was what we saw with Copenhagen here. They were a team that had left everything in the group stage, whether they were overawed, whether it was coming back after that winter break, whatever it was, they were clearly outclassed by Chelsea. Chelsea were quicker, they were stronger, more technical ability. Copenhagen were giving them far too much space a number of times. It looked like you're watching the whole 90 minutes was the kind of stuff you would see in the last 15, 20 minutes of a game. It was wide open. SEN was running 15, 20, 25, 30 yards with the ball at his feet. Copenhagen were just dropping back, giving them lots of space, finished up making a mistake on the goal. And Doi was a big disappointment. He spent his time flopping around trying to look for free kicks and penalty kicks. That obviously didn't work. Copenhagen were just a yard, at least a yard off the pace. and you cannot see any way that they can get back in this tie. It was just a pretty futile performance by the Danes, and no place near the Chelsea, the level we saw from Chelsea.
Up front, Anelka and Torres paired together once again. Torres still to score. He came
very close.
Improved or still quite ponderous and laborious?
He's getting chances. And earlier in the season when he was playing Liverpool, he wasn't given the chances. So it's eventually going to come good. Mm-hmm. But there's I think, another angle to this as well. And the angle I want to kind of put out there is, you look at Torres, let's say he starts scoring. Now, Drogba hasn't been scoring as freely as he used to.
Because he's so old, Bobby.
Well, he hasn't got a lot. He's 32.
But
he hasn't got a lot of miles on these legs. He really didn't start as he's 24, so I'm not sure we should be dismissing Drogba as the old guy.
Totally in agreement with you on that.
So you've got Torres. So you're taking, if you play Torres instead of Drogba, you're taking Drogba's goals out of the team and replacing them with Torres. How much progress are you actually making? I'm not sure you're making that much progress. Certainly, you're getting a bit younger player. You're going to extend the life a little bit down the road, but I'm not sure that the impact is going to be that much. But he is going to come good and he's going to score goals. So far anyway, he looks to have a little bit of a better relationship with Anelka than he does with Torres. So you're in one of these situations, and it's not unusual sometimes when we see these rotation of three strikers. Go back to the time when Berbatov and Robbie Keane were playing together with Jermaine Defoe, the threesome at Tottenham. And the bottom line was, Robbie Keane was the one that possibly, if you looked at the scale, you looked at 1, 2, 3, Robbie Keane would be number three. But Robbie Keane played better with Berbatov or Defoe rather than Berbatov playing with Defoe. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe that situation at Chelsea as well. You'd look at maybe an order would be Torres or Drogba at number one, number two, whatever, Anelka number three. But maybe Anelka, the chemistry works better with either Torres or Drogba as opposed to Torres and Drogba. So he might be facing a situation where Anelka is actually the guy, the stick that stirs.
So therefore, can it be argued that Chelsea have paid 50 million quid for a player who will be rotated every second game in order to make Drogba do better than he is doing at the moment?
You would sense that Drogba's in one of these sulky stages. Mm. And you wonder if Drogba's actually going to be around next year. Maybe this was a longer term in terms of the signing of Torres. Was more about Drogba moving on. Because I just can't see Drogba being that kind of player, or Torres being that kind of player, that are looking to be rotated. Drogba at 32, do you want to be rotated every second game, or do you want to go someplace else where you'll be appreciated and start generating some game time? I just can't see Drogba being the kind of guy either in the dressing room that would really take well to that. I think he'd turn out to be more of a problem than it's worth. So I really wonder if Didier Drogba will be around at Stamford Bridge come September.
Robin! Oh, and it's a tap-in for Gomez! And we have got a goal! It's Mario Gomez, who's been Bayern's main man this season. And Julio Cesar's fumble in the 90th minute has given Bayern a goal that probably they deserve.
One we were all waiting for. At the San Siro, repeat of last year's final. For the Romantics, this was incredible moments. For Bayern Munich, it turned out really well. For Inter Milan, well, they're still well in the tie, though, aren't they? Or are they?
I don't think they are, actually. I thought Bayern were far better than them. I don't think the scoreline... I think, well, maybe the scoreline reflected they were worth a one-goal win. Two would have been perhaps overplaying it, but I think they were definitely worth a win. I noticed there was some Inter players saying they thought they should have won. I think apart from a 10-minute spell, Inter really didn't have the better of the play at all. I thought Inter asked very few questions of the Bayern defence, particularly the centre defence, which we thought was potentially a weak spot. The Bayern keeper had a couple of good saves, but generally I thought Bayern played the game as a dominant force, held the ball well, passed the ball well. Gustavo, I thought, was terrific in the midfield. He looks like a very, very good player. They've only got him on loan, I think, at the moment. You've got to think that's going to be a permanent move, and that might be more around financial regulations than anything else. to try and get a loan signing at the moment and sign him in the summer. He looked very good. Schweinsteiger, very effective game without being outstanding. Robin was the more dangerous of the two wide men. Thomas Müller still looks like he's maybe playing with a little bit of World Cup hangover. Gomez could have had maybe more than the one goal, but certainly potted the winner quite nicely. I thought overall, just a very good performance from Bayern. Inter looked like they were a good half a yard short of pace in trying to compete with Bayern Munich. And perhaps just lacked that creative force. Schneider was kept quiet. I think a lot of that was down to Gustavo. Mm-hmm. They played with Motta, Cambiasso and Zanetti in midfield. Kivu looked a little bit uncomfortable against Robin at times, as he did in the final last year.
Yeah.
Lucio, I thought, did remarkably well considering the player that had been out.
Yeah.
Ranocchia gave the ball away a couple of times, which was disappointing, but generally I thought he acquitted himself quite well. I just thought that Inter lacked that creative spark and that little bit of pace to compete with Bayern Munich. So I would be surprised if Inter can find a way back in at this tie.
It was interesting from Louis van Gaal at the start of the game. Gustavo started at left back.
Yep.
And then literally when Schneider took up his role that he's become accustomed to, in a slightly altered formation up top for Inter, then Gustavo moved into central midfield to keep a very close eye on Mr. Schneider.
Well, it's the whole Bayern setup has been quite fluid. I was going to say for the last few weeks, that's not actually true. You could actually say it's been quite fluid for the whole year.
Yeah.
You look at a number of players. Gustavo's played left back. He played centre half or centre back for Offenheim, mm-hmm. but he started most of his games left back or in midfield for Bayern. Pranić has started left back. He's also started as a defensive midfield player as well. So there's a lot of fluidity. Timoshchuk, who we regard as more a defensive midfield player, has become a centre back.
Yeah.
Batstuber, who's left back last year, is now a centre back. So there's a lot of movement. Philip Lahm's about the only one that's sitting still at the moment.
And he can play left back too.
As we've seen before, he can. So I think that was more about there was enough flexibility in the team. No matter how Inter deployed Schneider, they were going to find a solution to that.
What do Inter do in the return, like? Apart from score goals.
Hope Melito gets back, because if Melito gets back, that allows him to play Eto as more of a support striker and gives him a little bit more pace and support. It just was a team that looked like they lacked jump. And maybe this is an Italian football problem at the moment, because you look at all three of the games, Milan against Tottenham, Shakhtar and Roma, Inter against Bayern Munich. All three Italian teams looked like they were short of pace.
And all three of them lost at home in their first leg.
Yeah, disastrous. The seed is already sown for the next, I guess it's 2012-2013, Italy are going to lose that fourth Champions League spot. Germany are now in that. Not only are they got more coefficient points this year, but you project over that last 5 years, then they're above Italy. And I think we're almost at the point where Italy cannot recover from this situation. So they are now in a position where they're almost like a club team who have missed out on a Champions League money. Now they're going to find it harder and harder to get back that extra position. And Germany looks like the team that are going to, or the country that will take that spot over.
It's interesting because people have been talking about this in the last while as Italian football in European competition has struggled. People are still mentioning the Calciopoli scandal as something that is hanging over the whole country. But ultimately, I mean, you can't argue with... I mean, it's just so consistent. I mean, there hasn't been one team that has shown glimpses or...
You see it through Europa League as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think it's systemic. I think maybe the scandal was the straw that broke the camel's back, but it's been a long time coming. It's been a league that had its heyday in the 90s. Mm. There was used to attracting the big names and paying the big money.
Yeah.
But everything from the system right through to the stadiums. The stadiums are outdated.
The attendances.
Yeah. I think it was disastrous for Italian football that they lost out on the 2012 hosting of the European Championship. If they'd got that hosting right, they would have got the new stadiums. They would have built new stadiums, which obviously they're in need of, and that would have, I think, been the motivation to address a whole bunch of other problems. But there's some real key systemic problems that have not been addressed over the years, and they've built up, and now Italian football is paying the penalty. So the final game this week was Marseille-Manchester United, scoreless draw at the Velodrome. Great atmosphere. Talk about grounds.
Absolutely.
Great.
Terrific.
Absolutely terrific, wasn't it? Alex Ferguson, a little bit disappointed. How much does Ferguson have a right to be disappointed? Or is he the author of his demise?
I don't know how he can be disappointed. I don't know how he can be in his post-game press conference scratching his head. He came out afterwards saying, yeah, you know, score a draw away from home, get him back to Old Trafford, you know, are in with a good chance there, but disappointed that we just didn't get that goal. You know, that away goal is so important. Well, maybe you didn't get an away goal for the following reasons. You play Wayne Rooney and Dimitar Berbatov in the first 11 away from home in Europe. Sounds great, but you put Rooney wide left. You play five across midfield. You have Berbatov up front on his own with no service and no support from elsewhere. Oh, and also your midfield can't hit two passes consecutively in a row. So perhaps that's why you didn't score a goal. United were terrible, for lack of a better term. They obviously had injuries, but the pre-game was pretty horrible sounding because people were talking about Ryan Giggs as if he was Lionel Messi. Manchester United have injury worries, no Ryan Giggs in the team. I mean, I don't know how a guy at his age with the amount of years on his body is supposed to carry this United team toward what, Champions League glory. He obviously has had a great season, but you know, people still refer to him as one of the key players for Manchester United. It's worrying. They had a three-man centre midfield. Carrick, Holding, and then Fletcher and Darren Gibson were named alongside Carrick in that centre midfield. Gibson lasted 70 minutes before Scholes replaced them, and United then went 4-4-2. And suddenly, they play two up front. They've got a little bit more urgency, and they look more dangerous and potent. Didier Deschamps saying afterwards, oh, when United changed their formation, well, they put us on the back foot, and we were behind the ball a little bit, which would, for me anyway, translate as, why didn't Manchester United play to their strengths? Marseille did not really create anything in the game. You had Rooney isolated wide left, covering what? There was no threat from that right side from Marseille. Well, certainly from a right back perspective going forward. So I was confused watching it. I thought that Marseille were there for the taking if United really wanted to do that. But they were soft and their retention of the ball was hopeless. Obviously, you've got a return leg back in Manchester, which is the silver lining, I suppose. They'll still get through, but gritty, under-inspiring, sloppy, scrappy, and I suppose it can be categorised as a stereotypical Manchester United away performance in Europe, for lack of a better term.
Is Ferguson's conservatism that he's continuing to show beyond the group stage and showing this knockout round, is that sort of belie is that an indication that he lacks confidence in this squad? You look at John O'Shea coming in instead of young Raphael. Raphael, a bit hot-headed, but he's an exciting talent and he certainly likes to go forward and he's aggressive. But you put John O'Shea in there, Dan Gibson, I think there's real question marks whether he's got it. Darren Fletcher, yeah. A lot of mileage on Darren Fletcher this year. Michael Carrick. I'm still amazed at the number of people when I read blogs and I read websites and I read comments in newspapers and the little sections underneath, the number of people that still think Michael Carrick is an outstanding talent.
Is that Michael Carrick's mother, perhaps? Writing a
on his day against the right opposition, he can look like, yes, he can carve teams apart.
Yeah. He's great against West Ham.
But he's not, you take it up that level, he struggles, doesn't he?
Yeah, and it's clear. I mean, take your point about, you know, varying your formations and your lineups because you're not confident. 1999, say what you will, but Manchester United had a four-man midfield for pretty much all of that campaign. Beckham, Scholes, Keane, Giggs. When you've got that talent, you're not going to change it. So how often has United been tinkering with that midfield for what, the last number of seasons? Mm-hmm. They haven't got it right. They clearly don't have, well, arguably they do have a first choice midfield four.
But there is no successor at Scholes, is there?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the onus in Marseille was on Gibson. This was a moment, this was an evening when he had to step up to the plate and deliver. And as we were talking about yesterday, he had that impression of three touches, look around. And in a European stage, you can't do that. You don't have the time. It's like you're making that step up. It's almost like watching a player coming from a lower ranked club in England move to Manchester United, playing a European game, and you're keeping the same mentality that you've become accustomed to playing at that lower level.
Maybe flip. That's a good point there, Owen. Maybe flip it around. If Dan Gibson was playing for, say, Blackburn, would Dan Gibson be linked with Manchester United?
No.
Bottom line, isn't
that's
it?
That's the bottom line. Yeah. And I don't, you know, and it's not even a case of Gibson is 18, 19 years old where people can go, yeah, but he could grow into the role. He's 24 next birthday. He's been here for a number of years. Giovanni Trapattoni, his Republic of Ireland manager, is keen on him to move away from the club. And you can understand his frustration, you know, that obviously Ferguson sees something in him because he keeps on selecting him. He, you know, there's, you know, it's fantastic for your coach to put that faith in you when you're in a knockout round in Marseille and he goes, I want you to play that Scholes role. Amazing for your confidence. But it just seemed as if his confidence was knocked back by having that responsibility on his shoulders. And again, when you're looking at a young player, that's not the reaction you want, is it? You want a Wilshere. You want, here's your first England cap, your first England start, and he grows into that role. It's like something he's always wanted for his whole life, and he's excited and just buzzed about it. Gibson, watching him last night, he disappeared into himself and ultimately came off after 70 minutes. And does that say much about his future at the club? Potentially. But Ferguson is stubborn, as he's made a career out of being. You know, who knows? Maybe it's not the last.
And proven us wrong.
Exactly. So maybe this will be different as well.
So you mentioned Jack Wilshere in there, and the Dan Gibson comparison. So this Sunday we'll have the first silverware. We'll be decided in England. Carling Cup final. Arsenal, Birmingham. Sarcasm alert here. Apparently, Arsenal haven't won a trophy since 2005.
You don't say.
I was just shocked to read that and hear it many, many times. Birmingham, of course, last won a trophy in 1963. But you don't hear much about that, do you?
You don't. They've got a chance, I'm going to say. Not much of a chance, but you go into a final and you're completely written off. You've got an opposition who are fighting in a variety of different tournaments who have to take into account their priorities, how much do they really want a Carling Cup, and they've also got injury worries. And it's a one-off game. So it's, you know, I hate using cliches, but anything is likely to happen. It's tough for them, but, you know, we're hearing that Walcott is out for the game and Fabregas picking up an injury against Stoke yesterday. Which would leave him very doubtful. And, I mean, surely Wenger cannot play him.
But do you think that would really affect the way Birmingham will set themselves up, whether Fabregas plays or not? Like, there's a kind of, I think there's been a little bit more expansive Birmingham the last few weeks. Yeah. And I think the interesting thing is, I think it's one of the conventional pieces of conventional wisdom we follow. Well, you know, the team, when it's playing in the Cup, doesn't have to worry about the league. Maybe they've got relegation problems. They can play with more abandon in the Cup. But maybe Birmingham are a real-life example of that. They beat Aston Villa in the League Cup.
Yep.
They beat West Ham after coming back in the first leg, League Cup. Mm-hmm. Sheffield Wednesday. Birmingham looked like they thought they were Brazil in 1970. They're all running around, all wanting the ball, making runs behind. So maybe there's more to this. Maybe the Cups have done something for Birmingham in terms of their performances this year.
I think so. And, I mean, you find yourself in a final. I mean, how many times can these players look back in their careers and say, oh, well, I get to step out of Wembley and into great atmosphere, into with a piece of silverware on the line. So there's that to, not to be, you know, patronising about it, but there's that for them to look forward to. But these teams have played each other twice in the league already this season, and essentially the games were quite contrasting. At the Emirates, Arsenal won 2-1, and at St Andrews, they cantered to a 3-0 victory. And two kind of different Birmingham sides. At the Emirates, Zigic was there. Zigic scored, and he was a problem for them. The Arsenal centre-backs that day were Giroud and Skilacci. At St Andrews, Koscielny and Giroud were present at the back. No Zigic. I think they had Cameron Jerome leading the line up front with Bouchard in support. And Arsenal get an early goal. and it's curtains really from then on. You've got Van Persie, Fabregas, Walcott, Nasri running left, right and centre, and they just couldn't deal with it. So January Birmingham, they've gone, and even though no one really wanted to come to the club in January, they've got Obafemi Martins, who's arrived, and it's like, hey, check it out. We've got a new player coming into our club. This is fantastic. He seems to have had a little bit of a positive influence on how things are going. 3 games, scored once. But he's also meant, his arrival has meant that Alex McLeish has gone with two up top now, with Zigic and Martins. A little bit more creative, a little bit more flexible. And certainly, as I said, if Skilacci plays, I think Birmingham have something to look upon as a weakness. I think Skilacci has played 16 games in the league for Arsenal this season, and Arsenal have kept 2 clean sheets from those 16 games. And those games that stand out, 4-4 draw at Newcastle, he came on as sub, 2-2 draw at Wigan.
Scored.
And then, yeah, and he scored against Stoke yesterday, so we just can't forget. He does have his strengths too. But I do think he's a weakness, and I think that, you know, obviously, you know, you look at the problems that Stoke presented to Arsenal last night.
Zidic, you know, it's the same ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably largely frustrating for Birmingham fans out there to realise that they've got one way of potentially beating Arsenal. But I think once you do realise it's a consistent way of getting at them, well, it would be pretty foolish not to utilise it.
And you look at Zidic, this year he's become a scorer of big goals.
Yeah. I think three in his last four.
And you look at in terms of League Cup against West Ham, and the goals in the league he scored have meant quite a difference in terms of points for Birmingham this year.
Yeah.
So he might not score a lot, but if he's scoring goals that are winning games and winning big games for you, then yeah, you've got to use him.
Another thing that you just mentioned earlier on was that West Ham game in the Cup that came from behind, which is something that they've done on a number of key occasions this season. I mean, obviously they've struggled in the league, yes, but there have been isolated moments when they look to be kind of dead and buried and they've come back and got something out of a game. Obviously that West Ham game, but the 2-2 draw at Man City, the 3-2 win over Coventry in the Cup,
2-0 down,
and the games against Manchester United and Tottenham, they both ended in 1-1 draws. So even, you know, you look at it, if Arsenal get an early goal, it's really all about Arsenal's approach after that, because Birmingham really have shown a history of staying with it and staying in and essentially staying in the bout. So even if Arsenal score first, perhaps it's more about the psychology of Arsene Wenger's team as to where they go from there as it is about McLeish's team's response.
To me, watching Birmingham over the years with McLeish, it's been one of the most frustrating pieces is that when Birmingham actually commit to going forward, they can be an extremely dangerous and actually quite an entertaining team. But they almost seem to be in that mindset where we're going to try and hold on, try and nip something.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, we're down a goal. Oh God, we've got to attack now.
Yeah.
And suddenly they brighten up once the pressure's off. And I think that maybe a lot of it comes back to McLeish.
Yeah. I think there's a little bit of a pattern in goals that they have scored in that, you know, you get the big boys up from the back and, you know, the ball kind of bounces around a little bit and people kind of live off a few scraps, like Craig Gardner has popped up on a number of occasions, just picking up those loose balls that are popping around. So perhaps it's something similar that they need. But Arsenal, the threat that they possess. It's interesting, you mentioned the trophy thing. I was thinking about this on my way this morning and I was wondering how much Wenger would be thinking about trophy. Silverware, finally can put this to bed with my critics constantly chirping in my ear about how I haven't won a trophy in so long. Is that creeping into his thoughts, or does he look upon this as just another game? It doesn't mean anything to him.
I think he knows that this can take an immense amount of pressure off, even though it's a Carling Cup and it's been a competition he's used as a feeder competition for the first team in terms of giving the younger players an opportunity. I think it's massive in terms of taking the fan pressure off, taking the media pressure off as well. I think the real difficulty is making sure that pressure doesn't translate to the players going out. Because talk about Birmingham, you know, Birmingham will have their chance, but there's also the players know that this is probably one of the very few chances, if not the only chance, they will get to get silverware in their career. So there's pressure with that as well, the Wembley occasion. You look at this, the Arsenal side, it's not a team that's won very much. You go through the players, maybe Cliche's won something. I think Almunia was a substitute keeper. Hopefully he'll be a substitute keeper again this game. So you go through them, there's not a lot of players that have won. Fabregas, I guess you look at the World Cup and European Championships, but with Arsenal, there's not very many there. And if Fabregas doesn't play, I have a concern about Arsenal, because I think Fabregas has that ability to not just play horizontally, as so many of the Arsenal players do, and keep possession, but Fabregas has the ability to play a killer pass. He has the ability to look straight up the field, pick out a long pass, pick out a short pass. He dictates rhythm. He dictates so much of what is good about the Arsenal team. And if he doesn't play, I'm not quite sure that... In fact, I'm quite sure that Arsenal are not nearly as effective. You look at Nasri. Nasri's a great player. He's a wonderful player, but he's not a Fabregas. So you take Fabregas out of that team, and you've got a problem. If you can take Van Persie out of that team, if Van Persie isn't fit, then you've got a massive hole. So I think this is the potential for this game is to be a lot closer than anybody has the right to expect. When you look at the league positions and you look at the stature of the clubs, I think Arsenal, unless they really, really lift their game without Fabregas, and you don't see that very often, this is going to be a struggle for them. That's all we have time for this week. I'm Bobby McMahon, and on behalf of Owen O'Callaghan and producer Luke Crawford, thank you for allowing us to be part of your day. Until the next time, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Soccer Report Extra podcast. For more great soccer news, highlights, and analysis, watch the Fox Soccer Report every night at 10 p.m. Eastern on Fox Soccer and Fox Sports World Canada. And be sure to check out SoccerReportExtra.com daily for previews, opinions, and reviews. Music for this podcast provided by SoundJay.com.